Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Mark and Aceto podcast. I'm Mark and Aceto, and today's podcast is going to be part of a history and music series. And it's an interview I conducted back in August last year with musician Steve Katz. Now, if you remember back in March, my first interview was with Steve Katz. It went really well, only a problem was I didn't get it recorded. It was my first time really conducting a meeting on Zoom. I used my tablet, not knowing that I couldn't record on it. Yeah, we got through it. I was just a little bit frustrated that I couldn't get it recorded, but I got that figured out, and all was well. And it was cool, too, because during the interview, he kind of said that, you know, let's do it again sometime. They sent me up, and if you want to do another interview, that'll be awesome. I'm like, sure. It's pretty cool. So anyway, I can't wait until August or whatever, did the interview. So my primary focus on the interview was going to be about the Monterey Pop Festival, which was in 1967. Now, the reason why I did that for it was because I'm in the middle of researching 1967, which I'm going to hopefully get finished soon and get the episodes posted for that. So it was fairly short, which I guess in some ways it was good, but I wanted more questions too. I was just leaning towards the Monterey. That was it. That was my focus. And he asked me, do you have any more questions than that? Or is that it? And I says, well, that's all I have. So I just kind of winged the rest of it. So kind of bear with me for that. But yeah, I think it went really well, actually. Not lie. So to give you a brief history of Steve Katz, he was a member of a band called Blues Project from 1965 to 1967. They're from New York. They were part of like they kind of performed in the folk rock scene of New York, and Al Kooper was a member of the band, and Danny Cowell. But Danny Cowell was actually leader of the band. Around 1967, Al Kooper went to Danny Cowell and asked him, "I got some songs that I want to do that will be good with a brass section. Can we add some brass to our music?" And I think it's really cool when different members of a band, you know, collaborate on their own ideas. But I guess Danny Cowell said no, so Al Kooper left. The Blues Project played at Monterey, which is why I was, you know, I wanted Steve Katz in general for that this interview. And Al Kooper was at Monterey also as a solo artist. And it was later in 1967 when Steve Katz left the Blues Project and went with Al Kooper to form Blood, Sweat, and Tears, a band that combined brass with rock and roll. The first album was released in 1968. After that, Al Kooper left, was replaced with Canadian David Clayton Thomas, and David Clayton Thomas was one who sings lead on hits such as You've Made Me So Very Happy, Spinning Wheel, and When I Die. Those were like some of the hits that Thomas played on, or sung on, excuse me. Anyway, Steve Katz was with Blood, Sweat, and Tears for 5 albums. I think they were getting a little bit too jazzy, and he wanted something more rock, so he left, and that's why he left for. He went on to produce a live album for Lou Reed. Like I said, it was a great interview. Like I said, my focus was on Monterey, but I kind of winged the rest of it. It is what it is. It's going to happen, I guess. But anyway, without further ado, here's the interview I had with Steve Katz. Hello, everyone. Mark Aceto here. I am pleased to introduce today's guest. He was a member of the band Blues Project, who then went on to play Monterey Pop in June of 67. He then became a founding member of the band Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He had been a member of BS&T for the first 5 albums. Following his time with BS&T, he went on to produce for artists such as Lou Reed. Ladies and gentlemen, I present you the legendary Mr. Steve Katz.
Hi there, Mark. Hi there, everybody.
So first off, what was the whole experience at Monterey Pop like for you?
What was it? What was Monterey like? It was great. It was really fun. It was beautiful. The weather was beautiful. Even though it was raining, but when it rains in California, you know, it's still beautiful. But there was a lot of, there was a lot of people there that were just meeting each other that, like all the some great acts, like the Byrds and Janis Joplin and it was just like Otis Redding, and I got to meet everybody, and there was only like 10,000 people in the audience, and the shows were great, and which was makes it much more intimate than, let's say, Woodstock, which I also played at.
Yes. How did you find out that the Blues Project was going to be on the bill?
We had an invitation from John Phillips and Lou Adler. And it was before Al Kooper left the band. And when Al left the band, they wanted to rescind the invitation. We insisted that, no, we're still a Blues Project, so we're coming out.
Yeah.
So it was like, the West Coast people were sort of condescending to us, to all the New York acts, it was us, Simon and Garfunkel, Laura Nero, who they just like belittled, and Laura did a great show. They also didn't, one thing about the West Coast critics and musicians, or a lot of the musicians, is that they didn't recognize, and certainly the West Coast press didn't recognize New York groups. I mean, there was us, there was also the Rascals and the Love and Spoonful. I mean, these are great, like pop bands who had hit singles, and they weren't invited to Monterey, which I thought was
That's a shock.
Yeah.
At the time, did you realize that this may be something big?
What, Monterey?
Like it's going to be a big thing.
As soon as I saw, I was on the side of the stage when Janis Joplin did Ball and Chain, and that was just amazing. I saw Hendrix play. I actually was having dinner with him just before. Well, dinner was a hot dog backstage. I shook hands with Otis Redding and watched his show. And yeah, you had to say, wow, there's a lot of things happening here that are just so beautiful and so wonderful. And every record company executive was there because they knew that this was happening, that this was going to be the next big thing. Was going to be, like counterculture rock and roll, sort of.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you, what other performances in Monterey stood out for you, and why? Like you said, Janis Joplin was really great there.
Well, one of them was Ravi Shankar, who was wonderful anyway. But what was really stood out for me was because it was raining when he went on, and as soon as he started playing the first notes, the rain stopped and the sun came out. So.
Oh, nice.
It was that kind of festival, it's just wonderful. But yeah, Janis's show was great. And like I said, Otis Redding. I mean, of course, Hendrix really was the showstopper because he did Fire that night and set the car ablaze. Everybody was really great.
Nice. Yeah, what was your reaction when you saw Jimmy play Wild Thing on that stage?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, it was just everything he did was amazing. Mm-hmm. Everything he did anyway was amazing. So.
That's awesome. Were there any performances that you didn't really care for?
Wild Thing was written by, who wrote that, right?
I know the Trogs did it. I know that. But I don't know who the writer was, no.
Yeah, it was John Voight, the actor, his brother.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And who is also Angelina Jolie's uncle.
Yeah. Really, that's interesting. I never knew that. That's really interesting. Were there any performances at Monterey that you didn't really care for? Like, just, I don't know, these guys aren't even that good, or was everything this on spot? You dug it?
No. Everything was great, and everything was fresh and new, and it was wonderful. Everything was... I can't think of anything that, oh boy, that wasn't very good. Or
yeah,
everything was just wonderful.
It was amazing. I have the video of it.
We're on the video in the outtakes of that Criterion put out on Monterey Pop.
Mm-hmm. I have that. Yeah, I saw that. It's really amazing. Really amazing. Some of those. So in our previous interview, you mentioned something that you were very shy when it comes to playing on stage. or you weren't like, you were kind of quiet on that, or you know, like, yeah, you weren't.
I've always been, I've always had stage fright, actually, up until just recently, because when you get to be my age, you just don't give a damn, you know, but you give a damn, you don't get as nervous as you did.
Right.
So I used to just sort of like stand there, and I couldn't wait to have, during a drum solo, you know, I would, you'd see my cord going out to the end of the stage where, so I can have a cigarette, you know, and all my nerves. But yeah, it was, I've always been sort of shy.
Yeah. Did like Monterey kind of help you with that, with the type of, with the audience, with, or was it, how did you feel on Monterey, I guess? Sorry, I had to rephrase that for a minute. Did you feel, that ring you out a little bit, like, as a performer?
I think by that time I was pretty relaxed with the Blues Project. I mean, we had our songs down, and the film, they put the flute thing in there, and I'm playing bass. It was the only thing that I played bass on, because Andy was playing flute. Mm-hmm. But, and it was a pretty easy part, so I was pretty relaxed. I think the songs we did were pretty easy. So, and the band was about to break up, so
yeah.
Well, I wasn't that nervous. But...
No, that's good. That's good. In your own words, do you think Monterey changed the way the audience maybe viewed concerts? You feel?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And Monterey was the first rock festival, actually. I mean, yeah. There were concerts in New York, like Murray the K would put on, his extravaganzas at the RKO 58th Street or the Brooklyn Paramount. But mm-hmm. this is an outdoor concert that was the beginning of the counterculture basically expressing itself, you know, like Big Brother and Hendrix and even the Mamas and Papas It was all of this bubbling under 60s underground stuff, counterculture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It met at one place. It was the first time it did, and that was at Monterey.
Do you feel Monterey was a true definition of the Summer of Love, or one of the?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, because you know, it was so close to San Francisco, and everything evolved as far as Summer of Love around. Kate Ashbury and that whole area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and of course, like I was said before, New York had its own 8th Street, you know, and Soho and stuff like that. Its own craziness and, you know, but Summer of Love was, I guess more kids ran away to Kate Ashbury than they did to New York.
Yeah.
It was more of a struggle, you know. Weather was better in California.
Yeah, but I don't know about that. I've been in New York once, so I mean, when I was there, it rained. But I mean, it rains everywhere. It seems like so. I mean, I'm sure it is better. You know, sunny California than it was. So
New York now is very different than New York was back in those days.
Yeah. That's all I have, honestly. I just want to ask one more thing here. Is there anything else you'd like to add from the audience to know? Anything else that I didn't touch base on?
No. No, anything you want to ask me is fine.
Okay. That's all I got, honestly. That was fast. Wow.
You just wanted to talk about Monterey?
Yeah. Well, I guess we can go into I know Woodstock, it was raining there. I remember you didn't have much. So I guess let's talk about Woodstock a little bit. Yeah.
Woodstock was very uncomfortable. And mm-hmm. It was like the anti-Monterey in that we went on at 2:00 in the morning. There were just too many people there. The kids were there. It was just like hundreds of thousands. When we went on stage, it was like playing in front of a dark curtain or something. You know, they could have been like broccoli hedges out there. You know, you just couldn't tell. So it lost its intimacy. 2:00 in the morning, and it was drizzling, and of course we weren't in tune because of the humidity. But they put out the concert series and. The whole concert was put out on the CD 2 years ago. And our set was great on the CD, and I couldn't figure out why. And I called our sax player, Freddie, and I said, Freddie, I remember that we played terribly, that it was really uncomfortable and awful at Woodstock. And he said, yeah, that's what I remember also. I said, why does it sound so good? And then I saw an interview with Andy Zax, who produced the Woodstock, and Andy said, the only problem that I had was mixing Blood, Sweat, and Tears, because they were so out of tune that I had to automatically tune them, put them in tune. And that's why it sounds so good now. But I'm glad he did it, you know, because it's one of our best sets. But it was basically very, very uncomfortable at Woodstock. Monterey was like the beginning of something. Woodstock to me was sort of like the end of something. It just became too large. Then it became all the corporations, you know, came in after that and tried to co-opt, as we used to say, what the counterculture was trying to do.
Yeah, I know that feeling exactly. So I guess going back again, how did Blood, Sweat, and Tears form when you left Blues Project and formed Blood, Sweat, and Tears?
Well, we came out of the like I said, Al Kooper had left Blues Project just before Monterey, even though Al performed at Monterey, solo act. And then after I left, Al called me a couple of months later, and said, you know, like he wanted to restart his career in London, and would I back him up with a couple of friends at the Cafe Agogo in a benefit concert, and so we could raise the money for the airfare. Nobody really came, so he raised enough money to take a cab to the airport and back. So I said, well, Al, since you're not going, let's start a band, you know. And Al always had this idea of putting horns with the Blues Project, which Danny, the leader of the band, always vetoed. And I said, yeah, that would be great, you know. And that's what we did, and it became Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
That's nice. When Al Kooper left, you replaced him with David Clayton Thomas. How did you figure out he was going to be the new singer for the band? Did you have bring in a couple people, and he's the best one, going to choose him?
Yeah, we had auditions, and it was between David and Dick Wagner, who I wound up working with later when I was producing Lou Reed, and Dick was in Lou's band, and also worked a lot with Alice Cooper. Dick is like a legendary musician. He just passed away. He was a good friend. Dick passed away a couple of years ago. But Dick was a really good singer, but David was a great singer. And, you know, his interpretation of Billie Holiday's God Bless the Child just really floored us, and he was the right person for the band. So.
That's a great song, yeah. Love that song. I guess, why did you leave Blood, Sweat, and Tears? When did you decide to leave?
Yeah. I was after 6 years, and the band was starting to take it more of a jazz direction, which I just wasn't able to do. And I wanted to get back to rock and roll, and I was becoming close with Lou. Lou asked me to produce his album after Berlin, which we did as a live album, which is Rock and Roll Animal. And that was sort of like, so I left Blood, Sweat, and Tears to work with Lou and to basically get my studio chops together as a producer. Nice.
How was Lou Reed as a person? Was he, how was he in general to work with when you?
Miserable.
Miserable.
I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah.
I mean, we got along, but Lou is a miserable person.
Yeah. I won't tell him that. Okay.
Okay. I mean, he was doing too many drugs, and but he was also the funniest person I've ever known. So
nice, yeah. He's a great musician. I love Lou Reed. That's a great musician. I think I know you wrote a book too. Sorry. I just did Monterey questions because I'm kind of focusing now on 1967. I'm kind of focusing on Monterey here. In this period too, that's why I kind of said, well, let's do Monterey. And that was pretty fast how we went through Monterey in almost 5 minutes, it seemed like. But I'm just trying to fake it now, what questions to bring up. I know you wrote a book. Tell us about your book here.
It's called Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. And the subtitle is Steve Katz a Rock Star? Because that was the title of a magazine article about me years ago.
Okay.
Because I didn't know whether I was or not, because I was still going to my parents' house to get my laundry done. And Yeah, and so anyway, I wrote the book 5 years ago. It's my memoirs, and I'm pretty happy with it. You know, I try to make it entertaining, and you can still get it on Amazon, and you can download it for Kindle. You can get an audio book, but it's so do that, people. And also my new CD, Juggle, the Juggle that I put out last
year. Yeah, I heard some of that. That's pretty good. That's really good, actually.
Exactly. Thanks.
Yes. Very inspiring. Honestly,
you can get that on my website, which is stevekatzmusic.wordpress.com.
Okay. Okay. Definitely, check that out. Definitely, that's awesome. Yeah.
If that's too much to remember, you can just Google me. My website will come up.
Yep, definitely. It always does. Like if you Google like ESPN, well, there it is. Okay, ESPN's up, obviously. Yeah, it's pretty easy to remember, honestly, your website. So honestly, that's, I think, all I got right now. Like I said, I'm just faking this last part. I'm just trying to think what else, because I remember last time I interviewed, I asked you all these other questions too about, you know, Woodstock and your early days and stuff before Blues Project. I guess while we're on it, when did the love of music first come about? When you first, like, how that come about? When you first heard music, and like, oh, I love this stuff. I'm gonna be a musician one day, maybe, or something.
Oh, that when I first I wanted to be a musician. Well, I first loved music when I was like 5 years old. And I would listen to records, and I went out to, when I was about 8 years old, I would go to the record store. You know, I was a toddler going into the record store, buying Harry Belafonte and Eddie Fisher records. And then I would start singing along with these records, right? But so I just kept singing and singing, and I used to sing in front, you know, on my front porch where my parents lived. And I didn't pick up the guitar until I was 15. And then I started taking lessons from Dave Van Ronk. And that's when I first started accompanying myself, basically, and playing lead when I got into a rhythm, and then lead in the Blues Project.
I guess going back again, how did the Blues Project form exactly?
Well, it was the Danny Kalb Quartet, and Danny was also a student of Dave Van Ronk, guitar student, and I was teaching acoustic guitar at a place called the Fretted Instruments on 6th Avenue in Manhattan. And Danny's rhythm guitar player, who was Artie Traum, Artie had left to go to Europe. And Danny asked if I would take his place. I said, I never played electric guitar before, you know. He says, well, come on up and we'll put a pickup on your guitar. And come on up to the Night Owl tomorrow. And I did, and auditioned, and I got the job. It's actually a funny story, but you have to read my book. I can't give away too much. My book, the story is very funny.
I hear you. Yeah. Check that out. That's awesome. And all honestly, that's all I got. Actually, that's all I can think of right now.
That's okay, yeah. Mark. It's nap time for me anyway.
Oh, yeah. Time for a nap.
I have to take the dogs out. I have to feed. I have to give the parrots their little Chinese noodles. And take my nap, and then my wife's in Iceland, so she's going to call me in about an hour or so.
Oh, nice. Iceland. Nice. Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
There you go, folks. Steve Katz. Great guy, actually. Very great guy. Anyway, that's all I have for this episode. Be on the lookout for more episodes. Hopefully my next one's going to be part of the History of Music series, 1967. I'm going to get rolling on that. I mean, that should be an interesting year. That's why it's taken long for me to research it, because there's so much going on that year. You know, they call it the Summer of Love, and it was such a historical year in music, you know, that I want to try to be as precise as possible for the episodes when I record them. So, anyway, when I'm going to get that out, I'm not sure, but definitely when I get it ready to go, you'll be the first to know. Anyway, thank you for tuning in for the Mark and Tuxedo podcast. You can check my podcast on apps such as iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts, and you can check my YouTube channel, The Mark Inesito Podcast, for the videos. Thank you and have a great day. God bless. Goodbye.